You're listening to The Fifth Estate, a podcast from the Wheeler Centre. This episode is called Public Health and Drug Policy Today. It was recorded live on Tuesday, the 12th of June, 2018. Our host, Sally Warhaft, is joined by Fiona Patton and Richard Di Natale.
Dr. Richard Di Natale is, of course, the leader of the Australian Greens. He was elected to the federal Senate in 2010, and his portfolios include health, multiculturalism and sport. Before this, he was a GP and a public health specialist. His priorities in this area included preventative health and particularly in the drug and alcohol sector. He is the co-convener of the Parliamentary Friends for Drug Policy and Law Reform, and several other friends groups. I won't list them all, but you've obviously got quite a few friends, Richard, so that was very promising. Fiona Patton is the founder and leader of the Reason Movement, which, of course, formerly was the Sex Party, elected in 2014 into the Victorian Legislative Council for the Northern Metropolitan Region, and one of a number of crossbenchers, of course, who hold the balance of power in Victoria's upper house. Fiona was formerly best known as the CEO of the Eros Association. So please give him another round of applause.
I'm also the convener of the Friends for Drug Law Reform in Victoria, but can't say I've got many friends.
How
in
many have
that
you
group.
Got?
I think there's seven of us.
How many have you got, Richard?
Probably about the same.
Okay.
I don't feel so bad now.
who are they?
Well, I don't know that they want to be out. Okay.
So the purpose
the aim
is that it's quiet.
To try and keep it quiet and encourage those voices to speak up and become more active.
Okay. Gee, it's a small number, isn't it? Yeah. That's, all right. Well, look, this is an issue that at the Fifth Estate, at this series at Wheeler Centre, I've come back to numerous times over the past 6 years. Former guests on this topic have included Alex Wodak, who's an internationally renowned Sydney doctor in this area, and more recently the former New South Wales Premier Bob Carr came down to talk about it last year in our endeavour to try and push along the safe injecting facility in Victoria, which he was a great supporter of and, of course, has now happened. But, of course, it's a conversation that needs to be continued, and it's good to have a little bit of good news with Victoria's first safe injecting room about to open. Much more to be done. So let's begin with that, though, Fiona. After years of resistance, Dan Andrew had a pretty sudden change of heart, it seemed, late last year in allowing a two-year trial. He said it was because the current approach wasn't working. He also acknowledged you specifically and Richard Wynne in helping to persuade him of the merits. Can you tell us a little bit about how you did that, how you persuaded someone who was locked in against it?
It wasn't just me, but what we were able to do was form a real campaign where when we thought to do it, that last year was the year, and it was after the second coroner's report had come down calling for the urgent introduction of a supervised injecting centre in North Richmond, where, you know, 26 people had died from an overdose in a 300 square metre area. So at the beginning of last year, the first person I went and saw was the police commissioner and said, this is what I want to do and I would really like your support. He wasn't able to provide that, but it started the campaign but we had the Salvation Army, we had the AMA, we had the Ambulance Employees Association, we had every drug and alcohol expert and organisation. And then the third coroner's report came down, again urgently calling for a supervised injecting centre trial. We had the residents up in arms about this, and we had the parents and the sisters and the brothers campaigning for this. And I think, and then towards the end, which was for me, I'd put up a private members bill to push this forward, which instigated a parliamentary inquiry. But it also, I got the police association, I got the police union over the line. And at the last moment, they supported it. And that was enough armour and coverage, I felt, for the government to support it. And you know, with due recognition to the fact that there was a by-election in Northcote where the Greens and Labor were fighting for that progressive vote. So I think that certainly the government felt that also enabled a correct time. But again, it would have been hard to go against everyone that we had rallied, including the Pharmacy Guild, where Richard and I have spoken together.
It's so frustrating when people in power, like police commissioners, the minute they retire, they run off and join these fantastic, boards saying we should do this. Former premiers, Jeff Kennett, of course, was an advocate for this. Yeah. And it would be so much more beneficial, I'm sure, for everyone if everyone could actually just say what they felt.
If I could just, one quick little anecdote on that. I went and saw the Police Association in February last year, and Ron Idles, who was the former police secretary, was retiring the next day. And he said to Wayne Gatt, the current secretary, I think we should support this. And Wayne said, this is not the first battle I'm going to have with the government. And Ron said, I support it. And I said, would you say that? And he said, tomorrow I'll say that when I'm retired. And indeed he did.
Yeah. The failure to persuade people whose minds are set on the current model, I guess, is the greatest challenge. And the opposition leader in Victoria, Matthew Guy, is dead against it still. Richard, how do you go about, persuading people that perhaps there's another way to look at this?
Gee, Sally, I wish I knew the answer to that question. I think we'd all be a lot more successful in our endeavours. I think there are a few things that come together. I think the first thing I've learnt is that evidence alone isn't enough to win an argument. And, if you're trained in a scientific discipline like I am, it's one of the most frustrating parts of the job is you can't come with a, here's the evidence for what works and here's why we should do it, because there are all sorts of other interests often in whatever issue you're talking about. I suppose I take heart and look at some of the other important social changes we've had recently. Marriage equality was one, and for years I couldn't understand why we continued to be lagging so far behind, and a number of things came together for that to happen. Physician-assisted dying is another issue where we've seen in Victoria, and I have to acknowledge the role of the Labor government, but it was, again, one of those things across party lines, and a number of things came together for that to work. You never waste a good crisis when one's on your doorstep, and I fear for what's coming down the line when we look at the US and the situation there with opiates and the opiate overdose epidemic, and I fear for what is coming here in Australia, and I think that will be an opportunity to advance the debate. You look at what's going on internationally, and recently we announced our policy for a regulated approach to providing people with cannabis. You build on the international movements that are working, and you're just hoping, you're hoping all the time that if you're pushing in all these different directions, that at some point a little, the door will open a bit and you can push through it. But if you're not doing that work now, if you're not advancing the national conversation, if you haven't done the policy work, if you haven't built the allies, then when that opportunity presents itself, you won't be there to capture it. So that's how I feel about this debate. I feel that we may be a few years away from getting some real breakthroughs, but we have to start the work now and we have to advance the national conversation, which I have to say is why it's so lovely to be here tonight and having that conversation in this sort of format.
Tell us more then about the policy for legalising cannabis, starting with the decision. This was, to me, a really big decision to say legalise rather than decriminalise. Mm.
So we have long held a policy to decriminalise, and I always, when I use that word, I use it very carefully because people don't often make the distinction between decriminalisation and legalisation. Decriminalisation is to remove criminal penalties associated with the use of the drug, much like Portugal's done. So I visited Portugal a few years ago. Portugal made the very brave decision at the time, it was on the back again of significant opiate overdoses, to remove criminal penalties associated with illicit drug use, and just to divert all of those resources that were previously going towards trying to capture, you know, and prosecute individuals who were using drugs, to actually providing them with a whole range of social supports. It's been very successful, by all indicators, been very successful. With cannabis, we went the extra step to say, well, actually, no, this isn't just about removing criminal penalties associated with the use of cannabis. If we're going to be smart about it, we'll actually provide it in a regulated framework. We'll make it available for sale. We'll legalise the sale of the product through authorised outlets. And the reason we did that, I think a number of factors. Obviously, what's going on around the world, as I said, in Canada, many states in the US, in Uruguay, in Spain, a number of other jurisdictions, this debate is a long way from where we are. In Australia, cannabis consumption's been going up. The cannabis arrests are going up. Nearly 7 million people in Australia have tried cannabis at some point or other. And ultimately, what we're doing is we're diverting a whole lot of resources going towards to where they could be going, to providing people who get into trouble with their drug use, with the treatment and support they need. We're wasting that. And not only just wasting it, we're giving young people criminal records so that they can't get jobs, and can't travel, restrictions, all sorts of stuff. And we also, by creating that stigma around drug use, we prevent people from coming forward. So people don't want to acknowledge if they do have a problem and seek treatment. So we built on all the models that have been developed around the world. I think we're informed by all the things that we liked about each of those models. And we've basically got a model that says, if you want to grow it for personal use, you can. You can grow up to 6 plants, and depends on what state you're in, because some states have already got laws around that. But you can grow up for personal use. However, you can't sell it. If someone wants to go and buy a product and know exactly what they're getting, they go and buy it from a licensed outlet. The government, there'll be an Australian cannabis agency set up. It licenses growers. The growers have to grow it according to strict standards. It's then provided through licensed outlet. Plain packaging, you know exactly what you're getting, the ratio of the various, you know, THC, CBD and so on. You know that it's not contaminated. There are going to be less harmful strains available for sale. People will be trained, and if somebody's obviously got a problem with their drug use, they'll be able to provide them with referral pathways and send them and give them contact details for the sort of supports they might need. And ultimately what you do is you take it out of the hands of criminals who are making a lot of money out of it and want to drive consumption to more harmful substances in the hands of a much more regulated framework where it's the health of individuals that's driving the decisions we're making.
It's kind of hard to imagine wanting to have a little reefer if you have to go through all of that to get it, Richard, isn't it?
Well, from the individual perspective, yeah. You go to the shop and you basically say, I want that thing there, and you go and pay for it.
Yeah.
But you need the back end. You have to have the framework to make sure to give confidence that what people are getting is what they're actually paying for.
Fiona, what do you think of that approach from the Greens?
Well, it's been our policy since 2012. Mm. We took this approach some years ago, and I think it was my experience of looking overseas and looking at the models that were working in Colorado.
That legalisation is that, the better to leap forward in that.
Particularly with cannabis, given the size of the market. So in Victoria alone, in fact, actually probably in the larger Melbourne, it's worth $1.2 billion. And that's the police estimate of the grow houses operating through organisations, criminal organisations in Victoria. I was recently talking to someone who was out in a remote Aboriginal community in the Northern Territory, and they were smoking hydro cannabis from Victoria. So I support the Greens policy here, and we've certainly been campaigning for it for a number of years. When we are one of the highest users of cannabis, and Richard's right, we're also one of the highest arresters for cannabis. On Friday, the Canadian Senate just passed the cannabis bill C-45 with a number of amendments, but that will go back to their lower house and will come back to the Canadian Senate next week. I think that, and that will go through, and it's a very good model. They have some restrictions that wouldn't work for Australia, but we are looking at how we might be able to do it at a state level and try and bypass some of the federal legislation. Ultimately, it has to be a national approach, and we're seeing that in the US, where states are going it alone and doing that very successfully. Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Massachusetts, California, the list goes on. But yes, I think if we want to take that $1.2 billion out of the hands of criminals, we want to regulate the type of product that our largely young people are consuming. And at the moment, we have no idea what herbicides, pesticides, and adulterants that are used in the largely hydroponic growth of the product in Victoria. We have no idea of the THC levels. And as we're starting to see in overseas countries, is that the same people who are selling and producing and manufacturing the cannabis are also producing methamphetamine, are also providing some of our opiate and heroin market. And once fentanyl comes in, we're finding, you know, in Canada, they're finding cannabis with fentanyl in it being sold. So from a health and safety perspective, the governments need to regulate this in the same way that we have regulated alcohol, but we can learn from what we did with alcohol and tobacco.
I think just on that point, I think it's really important, because if you look at the experience, I'm a bit worried about what's happening in some states in the US, because, you know, they've taken in some states a much more sort of pro-business line, very minimal regulation. And so what you're getting is products that are marketed to children, lots of advertising. You're getting cannabis in some
preps. Agree this with is what that.
Because I think we probably differ on that point. But my concern is you put it in the hands of big business without strong regulation, then you risk making the same mistakes we made with grog. Very hard to regulate. You're getting a lot of products that are targeted at young people and at kids. As I said, there's these like Jelly Babies that are available. There's chocolate fudge. There's all sorts of stuff.
But with all due respect, I mean, most people living in Colorado, I don't know what they're called, Coloradians, cowboys, they don't like smoking.
Yeah, no, but I mean,
so edibles is actually a really important market.
No, I don't disagree with one of the biggest harms with cannabis is actually the fact that you smoke it. So
it's the way it's being promoted.
It's the fact packaging. That it's being promoted and marketed at young people, and they're building a very big constituency, very light touch regulation, and I think you risk making the same mistakes we've made with alcohol. And that's the word of caution I'd put over the top of this is if we're going to have a system, and this is why we've adopted the approach we've taken, plain packaging, and made very clear about what's in the product. You don't get brand differentiation. You don't get companies trying to market themselves based on product loyalty as opposed to what's in the product.
Yeah, I wouldn't agree with that. And I think that's, you know, that, you know, if we want it to be a government-run system, then I think there's all sorts of problems with having a government-owned organisation that grows and sells the cannabis. I think there is a role for businesses. I think there is a role for innovators, and I think there is a role for small-term cultivators, and where we've seen our wine industry go, and where we're seeing the really innovative work in alternatives to smoking, that is coming out of competition and it's coming out of business. In looking at Colorado, you know, you're not seeing, in fact, you're seeing a reduction in young people accessing cannabis because they're, you know, because they can't. And you're seeing an increase in non-smoking products, but I don't think you're seeing products dangerously marketed. I'm not opposed to plain packaging, but I would like to see the role of business and small operators and our own cultivators and our own farmers being able to grow and being able to sell and be able to create boutique markets and be able to innovate in this really interesting industry.
We're suggesting the government license growers, businesses. It's more at the consumption end. And it really is that model, the tobacco model. No advertising, no sponsorship.
I want to make
a point. What if I like Northern Lights over Californian Crush? Would you allow that?
I'd like to know how you're going to sell that to the Herald Sun, Fiona.
I know. when you look in Canada, when you look in, Colorado, which I think is actually a pretty highly regulated market.
No, we'd absolutely allow that. So you allow the colloquial name.
I want to move on from this because I don't want to get stuck just on this one policy, because I want to ask now each of you if the principles of your cannabis policy would apply to all illicit drugs.
The principles?
Of legalising.
So my view is, ultimately, what you're trying to do is take a drug-by-drug approach and you're trying to assess a drug on its harms. Would there ever be an argument for legalising crystal methamphetamine? No, I don't think so. No. Cannabis, relative to other harms, when you look at alcohol is a much dirtier drug than cannabis. And I'd go back to my sort of pharmacology days. Firstly, cannabis has no... There's no risk of overdose. People don't overdose and die from cannabis. Can't do it. You can with alcohol. You can get acute toxicity with alcohol in a way that you can't with cannabis.
But doesn't the same evidence-based approach to the use and harm of illicit drugs, isn't it the same that it's the illicit nature of, for example, heroin that leads to unnecessary deaths and deprivation, isn't the evidence the same?
Yes, but you don't apply the same type of regulation to each substance. So we've got a medically supervised injecting facility that will allow the consumption of crystal methamphetamine. I think that's a sensible policy to take because it's reducing harm sits above those other principles that guide you. But I don't think we should say simply because we're taking one regulatory approach to cannabis that we're going to follow the same model with other substances. We're on the verge of having medically prescribed heroin here in Australia. And this is, I suppose, worth reflecting on. Australia was once a leader in this area. In the early 80s, I mean, when we were confronted with the HIV epidemic, we had some very brave doctors and governments who advocated for clean needles. And as a result, we didn't see that epidemic spread in the same way as it did in other countries, amongst injecting drug users. We almost had a heroin trial. All that people might not remember, but all the state premiers at the time, state health ministers agreed to it. I think the opposition health minister at the time agreed to it.
I think wasn't John Howard...
He was the reason it didn't happen.
No, I thought that John Howard very quietly was very supportive of the of clean syringes.
He was very good, but never would tell
anyone about it.
Correct. And so it's interesting that they did fund. I mean, the work was done before him, but one of the things that the Howard government did was to fund needle and syringe exchange and other harm reduction measures. Mm-hmm. That is true. But he's the reason we don't have prescribed heroin. I think it was Michael Woolridge, the health minister at the time, conservative health minister, also supported the trial, and it was Howard's direct intervention that means we don't have one. We have been leaders and we've been there before. Mm. But that's a good example of a drug that I think under the right circumstances, we prescribe, as a doctor, I prescribe opiates to people who have an opiate, who are opiate dependent, to heroin addicts. I don't call it heroin because it's not heroin, it's methadone. But it's a legal opiate to replace an illegal opiate. Mm. Another drug called buprenorphine, it's an opiate. Again, we prescribe opiates under a medical framework. They're legal. There's no reason why in some circumstances heroin shouldn't be prescribed to people. So, yes, in that context, absolutely agree with you, Sally. I think, but getting the right regulatory regime in place depends on the substance you're talking about regulating.
And I think it's an interesting progression. I certainly would support that. And it was funny, we've produced this little booklet called When Drugs Were Legal. And this was an old book that I found in an antique store up in northern Victoria. And it was the register of a chemist in Camberwell for people who were getting prescription heroin, prescription cocaine, prescription indica, cannabis indica drops, and morphine. So they could go into the chemist and pick up that and they'd put their names and addresses, and there was lots of rules and regulations about how much you could give people and what sort of packaging it was. But, you know, in those days you didn't actually have many people overdosing. You had people using it carefully. And we look at where the position with supervised injecting centres came from. So, I worked on a needle exchange bus, mobile bus, in the late 80s, and it was wonderful to be able to freely have conversations about harm minimisation and harm reduction in to people who were about to use drugs. And you could talk to them about that. Then we talked about the fact that you'd be giving people syringes and going, good luck, as you go around the corner to inject drugs, hoping that nothing bad would happen to them. So that introduced the supervised injecting centre. Now we're sort of saying, come into our supervised injecting centre. We know that what you really want and what you are addicted is heroin, but we're not going to give it to you. We're going to let you bring whatever you might bring in, and we're going to make sure you don't die from it. You probably will get a whole bunch of long-term health effects from the use of the adulterated products that you've bought from the street. So it almost makes sense that if we've got these people, we know that they've got an opioid addiction, why wouldn't we give them an opioid so we could keep them safe, so we could reduce the harm, and we could start talking to them about bringing their lives out of chaos. And that's what the heroin program does. It all of a sudden, a heroin addict doesn't have to spend 12 hours of the day scoring heroin. They can actually start reuniting with their families. They can start rethinking education, rethinking work, and they can start bringing their lives together. And that that is the success of the heroin programs all over the world.
I'm always, or not always, but often surprised about where people fall on this issue. And so with your cannabis policy, for example, Richard, it was the funniest thing. I was listening to 3AW and Darren Hinch was on the morning program singing the praises of your policy with such a rational, he could have been the greatest sort of advocate for common sense on drug policy, and it did surprise me. And yet the AMA, you haven't been able to get their support, and I think that's a real problem.
So the issue does transcend left-right politics. Mm. It absolutely does. And the response, it's interesting, you sort of, a few years ago when we sort of were in this space, I think it was a Courier Mail at the time, photoshopped a picture of me with a crack pipe, you know, I can't remember what the caption over it was, but I had to explain to my mum what photoshopping was. Trying to sort of say, it's not real, mum, it's just photoshopped. And I know, and a few years before that, we were pilloried by the Murdoch press. The cannabis policy was interesting because, you know, I it really was quite, there were opponents, but nowhere near as hysterical as some of the interventions I've experienced previously, and a lot of support from across the political spectrum. I think public mood has shifted on it. The AMA is interesting, and I think a lot of the response from the AMA was driven by their former president, who was very conservative on this and many other issues. I'm holding out some hope that the new AMA president will be much more supportive, and indeed I'm very confident that the AMA, certainly here in Victoria, will take a very different approach to it. Mm. And, you know, the AMA position's more nuanced than what you think. They actually support decriminalisation. They support removing criminal penalties for individual use. It's taken them a while to get to the next step. And I think you'll find, you know, that position will evolve, particularly in light of the British Medical Journal, which only 2 or 3 weeks ago, maybe four, had an editorial saying it's time we tax and regulated cannabis and other drugs because what we're doing is not working. And this is a health issue, and we've got to start taking control of the debate and take it away from the law and order voices and make sure it's debated within the health space.
And I think we also need to start running that economic argument. And I know Dr. Alex Wodak talks about that quite often, that the way to get the Conservatives over the line is sell the economic argument about it. And the economic argument adds up. You know, and all of the results that are coming out of internationally doesn't show an increase in harm from cannabis. In fact, quite the opposite. It doesn't even show an increase in use of cannabis except amongst baby boomers, that they are actually going back to cannabis and try to, you know, relive some college days. But it's, those economic arguments, I think, are possibly what's going to start winning over some of the Conservatives, because you look at the cost. I mean, you might know better than me, but we spend billions of dollars trying to stop people use cannabis, and it's completely ineffective.
Well, the war on drugs overall.
Well, the drug trade's one of the biggest trades in the world.
That's right. I liked Nuno Capes, who you probably met over in Portugal. He's this great guy, and he was on A Current Affair on Friday night. And Current Affair is talking about the decriminalisation of drugs. And Channel 9 ran a legalisation of cannabis on Sunday night. But he says, we didn't stop the war on drugs, we just stopped the war on people. And I think that's a very good differentiation there. But when you're in Portugal, they will quietly say to you, we could probably stop the war on drugs as well, because that's not helping. It's not helping us keep a healthy society.
I want to talk about the stigma attached to addiction and what can be done from a public health perspective to try and address that.
Yeah. It's really interesting. It's one of the few areas, I reckon, where people think it's still okay to really denigrate somebody who uses drugs. You know, the word junkie gets thrown around, you know, almost viciously. And even in the medical profession, you see it. So people say to me, God, it must have been depressing working as a doctor in drug and alcohol space. So actually, it was one of the most rewarding parts of my professional career. It's very rare to be in an environment where someone can come in, their marriage has fallen apart, their relationships have all fallen apart, they've lost their job, they're homeless, they are really at rock bottom, and you can help them turn their life around. And often that's through substituting an illicit opiate for illicit one. That's what we do with methadone treatment. It can be incredibly rewarding. And unfortunately, and doctors, you know, you'll still see doctors who say, I'm not having junkies in my waiting room. No way, I'll prescribe methadone. no way I'll prescribe. You know, and I think to myself, yet, would you do that?
The rate of addiction for doctors is higher than most other segments of the population.
That's right. Yeah. And it was certainly something we've just undertaken a really expansive look at drug policy through a joint House committee in Victoria, and so the drug law reform.
Literally joint.
Yes, of course. I tried to get them all to smoke a joint, but you know, what goes on tour stays on tour, I suppose. But in that, we actually dedicated quite a substantial section of a chapter on the stigma and the harmful effects of stigma, and how we can change that. And certainly Canada, where in Vancouver, 4 people a day are dying from an opioid overdose. So in Canada alone, they've started this campaign in doctor surgeries. That person who might have a methamphetamine problem or a prescription drug problem or an or a heroin product problem, they could be your brother, they could be your sister, they could be your mother. There's this notion of removing some, changing the language, and trying to really instill that in our health organisations. I think also changing the stigma around drug use, and that's, you know, it's I've been encouraging, and Richard and I were both at a 420 rally, which is where there's at 20 past four on the 20th of April as a rally of support for cannabis law reform. Everyone lights up a joint in Flagstaff Gardens, and thousands of people attended, and it happens all over the world. But people coming out and saying, I'm not a terrible person and I may have the occasional joint, or I'm not a terrible person and I may have the occasional ecstasy tablet when I go to a music festival. I'm not a terrible person. And it's the same. I feel like it's almost like the same with the LGBTI community, that coming out and talking about it reduces the discrimination, reduces the stigma, and enables us to have sensible conversations.
It was interesting in Portugal. I agree with all of that, Fiona. When I went to Portugal, one of the things that changed there was that as part of the reform, they started to actually have genuine conversations about drug use. The education that was provided in classrooms was very different to what they'd done previously. So there's a central truth to this that we never talk about, and it's very risky as a politician talking about it. Why do people use these substances? Because it brings them pleasure.
Yeah. I know it's very difficult. Unproblematically.
Most people, I mean, as somebody who was a drug and alcohol doctor, I saw people when they were at rock bottom. Mm. That is the tip of a very deep iceberg. Mm. Most people who are using substances are doing it occasionally, probably a big chunk of them in this room.
It's a primal human thing. Since
that's right.
The cave,
that's
every right. community yeah. on earth has looked for substances right. to alter their mind.
That's right.
Mm. It's part of who we are. From the moment we discovered plants and berries and leaves that had a psychoactive effect, it's been part of the human condition, and people do it because they derive some pleasure from it. You have to accept that truth before you can move forward, and you have to accept that as part of that truth, some people will develop problems associated with their drug use, whether it's alcohol, whether it's illicit substances. Cannabis is not a harmless drug. It is relatively less harmful than alcohol, but it's not harmless. But that's true of legal and illegal drugs. And the reality is, unless we accept that and start to have real conversations with people about the lived experience of drug use, we're not going to move forward. So when the government runs an ad campaign with, young kids puking in toilets and depicting drug use as the most awful, horrible thing that anybody can do, that doesn't resonate with their own experiences. That's not how they experience drug use. So we've got to actually we have to have a much more sophisticated conversation. We have to accept, firstly, it's always been with us, it always will be with us. Most people do it safely, and our job in the role that we have is to reduce the harm associated with it, not to make moral judgments. A lot of this comes from, I think, people who make moral judgments about individual decisions, but to recognise our role is not to make those judgments, it's to reduce harm. And is what we're doing right now reducing harm? No, it's increasing harm. It's feeding criminals. It's causing corruption. It's giving young people criminal records. It's stigmatising drug use. It's holding us back. And that's one of the things, I suppose, you know, in the position I've got, that I want to take the opportunity to try and change.
And as we've seen, one of the amazing outcomes in Portugal, because Portugal, in decriminalising all drug use and possession, it didn't necessarily reduce the number of people using drugs. It just reduced the harm from it. But most importantly, and I think given that they now have sort of 17 years under their belt, what we've seen is there is a generation of Portuguese children who have had very honest conversations around drug use. And what we're seeing in that is in that cohort is that they're starting to use substances at a later age. And one of the great, one of the factors we know into problematic drug use is the earlier you start, the more likely you are to have a problem with that drug, whether it's alcohol, cannabis, heroin, whatever. So they've now successfully managed to delay first-time drug use in Portugal through their education programs. They haven't necessarily decreased drug use, but the harm to the harm that it creates has been reduced enormously.
What are the risks of the approaches that you advocate?
The Herald Sun.
I mean, the concern is if you liberalise access, you'll increase use. That's always the concern. I think our primary concern has to be, are we decreasing harm? Mm. And if we can answer that question honestly, then I think we can deal with other potential risks. The situation becomes a little more complicated when you're talking about some drugs that are legal and some that aren't. But, for example, in the US, we're talking about the experience with cannabis legalisation. There's been there's some evidence now to suggest a decrease in some states in alcohol-related violence, yeah. A decrease in the use of opiates and particularly harmful use of prescription opiates because people are substituting to cannabis. So there are a range of other intended, unintended benefits. And we have to also remember that one of the things, can I recommend, I'll make this pitch in case I don't, if you want to read a really good book about the history of prohibition, where we are now, Johann Hari, Chasing the Scream, really entertaining read, terrific sort of historical piece and takes us through to where we are now. By doing nothing, what we're doing is encouraging the production of harmful substances, this thing called the iron law of prohibition. When we banned grog, during the era of prohibition, consumption, production and consumption shifted away from less harmful products like beer to very concentrated spirits, because if you're making stuff and it's illegal, make it in the most potent form you can because you've got to ship it around and get it to places and not get caught. And that's what's happening. There's some evidence to suggest that crystal methamphetamine is in part a substitution effect from less harmful amphetamine-type substances to some of the most harmful. So what we're doing, I mean, I don't see too many downsides. I think all of the drivers and incentives are towards harmful, risky substances, high harm. And as long as we get the regulation right, then we're going to be reducing harm.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, when you look at what we've done in the cannabis area as far as new psychoactive substances, so the new psychoactive substances, the chronic and all of those products that were out there being sold. Now, the first one that came out was JWH-018, and it was actually a chemical that had been developed by Bayer as an alternative cannabinoid treatment, a cannabinoid product that may work in pain relief, but they couldn't get rid of the psychoactive effect on it. So they put it to one side, which of course got picked up by the illicit market, and the internet certainly helped with that. Now, where we are on that chemical warpath is a very different product, and prohibition cannot stop this. And when we look at where we're going with new drugs and new psychoactive substances, we won't be able, you know, we've got a government here that last year just went, we'll just ban everything. We don't know what it is, we'll just ban it. Now, that's not helpful, and it actually doesn't work. So I think this notion of prohibition is becoming more and more impossible. How can you prohibit something that you'll be able to create in a 3D printer? How will you be able to... they're not being able to prohibit stuff being bought online and delivered to the door. You know, the recent drug survey said that same-day delivery for cocaine was available to 70% of cocaine users in Australia. I mean, it's not probably cocaine. It's probably some really cheap chalk or something because we don't have cocaine in Australia. But it's the notion of prohibition just doesn't work anymore, and technology is really making that more and more obvious.
Before we go to the audience questions, there are so many programs going on around the world, really, really interesting. Some of them have been going for a long time. Some of them are more recent. I've been reading about wet houses, which are homes for alcoholics who just can't reach sobriety. Then they're just not going to stop drinking. And so they're given homes where they're able to drink, with the idea being that just because, you know, you don't have to be sober to have a home.
Yeah.
And with very, very, very promising sort of results for, for people at a really, you know, deeply tragic end of addiction. What, you know, are there programs that sort of come to mind that you've both, you know, travelled and seen all sorts of things? What are some that we might not have heard of, or things that really impress you from elsewhere that you'd like to see here?
I suppose your example highlights what is your treatment goal? And abstinence doesn't work for everybody. It works for some people, and for some people it's what they aspire to, and there are a lot of treatment programs targeted at abstinence. But abstinence does not work for everybody, which is why we have, as I said, opiate substitution treatment programs. It's why we've got heroin being prescribed to people. It's why in some settings... well, there were trials, for example, of amphetamine replacement therapies. The bottom line for me is I'm influenced by evidence, and the evidence for abstinence as a response to all substance dependence and substance abuse is not very good. And in some cases, controlled availability is much more successful. Now, heroin's a good example, and that would be the heroin trials conducted in the UK and in Switzerland have demonstrated that people can be prescribed heroin. Let's remember, this is opiates, if they're prescribed in the right dose, are actually a very safe and effective drug. You take them in the wrong dose, and the reason people overdose on heroin is because often they get a dose that's of high purity and they'll overdose as a result of that. But if you know exactly how much you're taking, they're actually quite safe. The harm is associated with first thing, and this is the experience of somebody who's heroin dependent. I wake up in the morning, where am I going to score? Where am I going to get my hit? Where am I going to get the money for it? How do I get the money for it? Every moment of every day, by the time you have become heroin dependent, revolves around how do I get the drug? And the second I've got the drug and I've moved on from the peace that it gives me, I'm looking for the next hit. And my life revolves around that. That is the cycle, and relationships don't matter. It's just about the drug. If you take all that stuff away and say, well, you failed, you know, you failed opiate substitution treatment, you failed a range of other programs, you've got this other thing over here that we can give you that we know is going to mean that all of those other things are dealt with, and then we can tackle the homelessness, the work issues, and the pain that's sitting underneath all of that, because in many, in fact, I'd say in the vast majority of cases, by the time we've got to that point, there's deep psychological, emotional pain that needs to be addressed. And if you can deal with the other stuff and you can provide the substance and you can work on those things. In a small minority of cases, it may not be possible. But what's the alternative? That person dies on the end of a needle, or actually is able to live, you know, a functional, productive life and feel valued.
Look, and just to add, I mean, add to that, I've been at the heroin treatment facility in Switzerland last year, and it's called HUG, which is just beautiful. And I was recently at the Canadian heroin treatment programs, and they are great. The statistics coming out of the heroin program in Switzerland that's been running for decades now is that they reduce crime amongst their clients by 99%. You know, these people are not committing crimes, which the Swiss very sensibly think this is very sensible. You know, so we stop them committing crimes. This is a good thing, isn't it? I think the Swiss, I went to one of the Geneva supervised injecting centre there, where they actually encourage people to stop injecting. And this is quite controversial in Australia, because they say, you know, injecting's actually really bad for you. Have you tried smoking it? Have you tried snorting it? So they actually start looking at harm minimisation programs within their supervised injecting centre. We're not ready for that in Australia. But I think those were some really sensible approaches to harm minimisation. And I was in Toronto, and I saw one of the alcohol treatment programs, and this was after two men froze to death because they had been denied housing because they were drunk, and they were not allowed into the emergency housing. So quite sensibly, the Canadians went, we do not want people freezing to death. So they provided a place where people could still have a house, have a home, well, have a place to sleep at least, and they would be given a certain amount of alcohol through the evening that would keep those people stable and keep them inside and keep them warm. And I think those were just remarkably compassionate programs to look at and see. And every single drug program that I've seen for people with problematic drug use, which is underlying trauma and pain almost all the time, is the compassion that leads either the country or the doctor or the social worker to that place. And I think if we as a society could be a little bit more compassionate to everyone, including people who use drugs, we'd be in a better place. And certainly seeing Canada and where they're going with their cannabis regulation, I think they've got it right, and I certainly would love to see Victoria or Australia follow in their footsteps.
If you'd like to ask a question, please just put up your hand, and an usher will give you a microphone.
Yeah, Richard and Fiona, I'd like to look a little bit upstream. We have a lot of alienation. The two of you have touched on it a bit. We're in a society of growing social inequality. We also have housing affordability. It's a big, big problem. We allow overseas people to buy a property, leave them unlived in. So what are your thoughts about changing the social structure? I know both of you probably have ideas on that.
That is such a huge question, and I'm going to try and bring it back to drugs. I certainly think that the alienation, the pain, and we both touched on it. When you look at the people who are using drugs in North Richmond, for example, when you look at over 50% of them have been diagnosed with a mental health issue. And those are those that have been diagnosed. And I think we can say that probably the majority of them have a mental health issue. If we can start treating those people as human beings and start putting them onto a path that shows that someone actually gives a shit about them, and, you know, even whether they're using or not, we give a shit about them, then that will change our compassion. And so in that small step, I think that starts us onto that path of not alienating those that we are afraid of and not alienating those people. And it does, it brings us forward. And it's the same with when we arrest young kids for having a joint or arrest young kids for having an ecstasy tablet. And we quite often, through that arrest, you know, if you're the nice white kid in Toorak, that arrest does not lead to a criminal conviction. If you're the black kid in Broadmeadows, it does. And so by changing our drug policies, we can start addressing some of the inequality that our drug laws have led to.
Look, I agree with Fiona. And I think, there are all sorts of reasons why we need to address inequality in Australia. There are all sorts of very good reasons as to why we need to address the inequities in the housing market, the fact that we have a tax system that privileges people on high incomes, that we're looking at, we've got a government that's looking to give people, you know, on $200,000 an extra $7,000 in their pocket, and they won't give a childcare worker or a nurse or a teacher even a fraction of that. I think we'll be in furious agreement on all of those things. At the heart of substance dependence, and I think it's really important to distinguish drug use from problematic drug use, substance dependence and substance abuse. The heart of that is disconnection and isolation, and that often comes from a place of trauma, emotional trauma. Some really interesting experiments done on mice, by the way, and it's, again, yeah. If you have a look at there's a rat park experiment where they basically showed how important it was to be part of a connected community. But here is coming back to something I said earlier. If we think that doing all of those things, and if we achieved all of the reforms that we're striving to achieve in each and every one of those areas upstream, is going to mean that no one's going to use drugs, it's just not going to happen. As I said, it's always been part of the human condition. I think it always will be. And the responsibility we have is to reduce the harms associated with that use, and to try and tackle those things that you talked about to try and prevent people from.
We'd have a lot more money to do that, wouldn't we? If we actually legalised
cannabis is worth. Cannabis? If we had a regulated cannabis market, we'd make $2 billion a year, which we could put straight back into drug and alcohol treatment, and have a lot more money left over beyond. So you know, there's strong economic arguments. That doesn't count the wasted resources that go towards policing as well. That's literally the excise. Instead of buying your dope from a dealer, you can buy it at the same price from a regulated outlet, a licensed outlet. It'll bring in $2 billion. We had it costed by the Parliamentary Budget Office.
And that's conservative, I think.
Mm.
Got about 1 minute and 20 seconds. I'm going to ask you if you're both election ready. Nothing to do with drugs, you obviously have an election coming up, and the Greens, well, you know, who knows when it'll be, but...
Federally. Are you never ready for an election?
Could be before Victoria's, couldn't it?
It could well be. I mean, there's a bit of scuttlebutt now that if they do badly for... Labor Party does badly in the... by-elections, that the government might be tempted to go early, might have a September federal election, although my money's still on a May poll next year, but it's possible we'll go early. You'd never feel ready. It's like studying for an exam, isn't it? And I don't think you ever walk into an exam and think, I know everything I need to know. But I think we're in a pretty good place, and, you know, I'm doing this job is an enormous privilege, and to be able to talk about issues that aren't being discussed publicly, this is an issue that affects the lives of so many people, and we've got two major parties in this country who run a million miles away from any conversation.
Although 150 people in the federal parliament, it is almost guaranteed at least one of them, and probably more, have a substance abuse or addiction problem. Almost guaranteed.
Yeah. And certainly a lot more will have a connection with one through family. I, you know, it, I, again, feel really privileged to have had this opportunity to be in Parliament for the 3.5 years. And I feel like I've kind of managed to achieve quite a lot in that time. I'd love to have one more term in there to finish a bit more. But I think going from changing your name from the Sex Party to Reason is going to be a challenge for us. But as I was saying to you, Sally, backstage, there's never a right time to do something like that. So running into an election where I know exactly what day it's going to be, yes. The 24th of November, with a new name, with a whole bunch of parties like One Nation, the Australian Conservatives, vying for those upper house seats, I'm up for a battle and I'm going to give it my all. But I'm also happy that we've managed to do a lot. Like we just didn't look back from the minute we got elected. So we just kind of went at a speed of maybe we won't get re-elected. So I really hope we do. Well, there's a lot more to do, but
is there room on the ballot paper for you to, you know, like Prince, the party formerly known as?
Yeah, we will be doing. I think one of the things about the Sex Party was it was funny, you know, and people liked that, and so I hope that we don't lose our irreverence and we don't lose that sense of humour. And I hope that comes out on the ballot. I don't know, they'll do like a cartoon as the logo or... But, yeah, we'll certainly try and remind people of that connection. However, I think a lot of those Sex Party... In the polling, in the small amount of surveying we've been able to do, I reckon half of the people voted for us because they loved our policies and the other half voted for us because they hated everyone else and they liked sex. It's not a bad reason.
No. And Sally, can
maybe
I...
Maybe the right reason.
You're in big trouble can if I that's just, right, of course.
If And I'll say this, I'll try and be magnanimous about it, but, I mean, the fact that we're having a conversation here between the Reason Party and the Greens, I'd like to think highlights why it's important to have a diversity of voices in the Parliament. Now, Parliament is better because of it, and I just urge people to think about the role of the Greens in the Senate and what it is that we can bring in terms of accountability and transparency and just advancing some of these issues publicly.
The votes, how many votes either of you get is not a concern of mine at all. But your friends in the parliamentary groups, that is. And I hope that can increase and perhaps these quiet discussions that you have with your respective colleagues is something where you get some voice. So good on you. And thank you very, very much.
Thank
Fiona Thanks. Patton and Chidi Natale.
Richard Di Natale and Fiona Patton joining Sally Warhaft for the Fifth Estate, recorded live here at the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne. Subscribe to the Fifth Estate and find more videos, podcasts and original writing at wheelercentre.com. We'll return shortly. Until then, take care.